chair recognizes a quorum.
At least at one time. Every one of these folks have checked in. And welcome to the Civil Law Committee. And what we would like to do, first up, is Representative Lesh has House File 2958. And so that, do I move it? Well, he could, right?
Yeah.
Representative Lesh, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd ask that House File 2958 be recommended to be re-referred to Judiciary.
All right. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Oh, wait.
Aye.
Okay, all right. Sorry. Representative Lesh, why don't you go ahead and present your bill? I believe you have an amendment.
I do, Madam Chair. I have the A14 amendment. And if I could, I would just have my testifier speak to that. But the bill basically allows a person who's brought a civil court action for violating Minnesota human rights to be entitled to a jury trial, just so it's confirmed of that. With that, I'd like to introduce my testifier.
Yeah, my name is Jim Castor. I practice law in Minneapolis with the law firm of Nichols and Castor. I have been there for 34 years. I represent employees in disputes, among other people, but I principally represent employees and have done that for over 25 years of my practice. This bill guarantees either party, the claimant or respondent, the right to a jury trial in a Minnesota human rights action. And it's a very important bill for a number of reasons. Fundamentally, the beginning point of the analysis is the Constitution requires a jury trial in such circumstances. The Abraham case has applied the right to a jury trial in a whistleblower claim. More recently, last year, the state Supreme Court decided that the right to a jury trial even applies to a motion for attorney's fees under a contract, which was typically and traditionally always something that the court determined. But if the essence of the claim is a claim for money damages, then the right to a jury trial is intact and preserved by the Constitution. This has gotten to the point of irony in terms of how these things are handled now in the court system. For example, I can go to the federal court, which is two blocks away from the state court in Hennepin County where I practice, and my client will get a right to a jury trial under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, the same claim in a different courtroom two blocks away, because the federal court has reached the question and determined that under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, which right now says that a court is the only trial a person gets, they have said, disregarding that statutory language, that the right to a jury trial is constitutionally protected under the Seventh Amendment. The same holds true under the Minnesota Constitution, and probably even with stronger reason based upon Abraham and the United Prairie Bank cases. I was thinking about how to tell the committee how strongly I feel about how the law is going to be decided when this issue gets to the state Supreme Court. I would bet my 1954 pickup truck, Ford pickup truck, that the state Supreme Court will find that there is a constitutional right to jury trial. And this is how, I mean, over the course of years that I've represented people, I obviously some of my clients have prevailed and many of them have lost. How a person feels when they lose a trial to a court, to a judge, is always that we got outmaneuvered by the other side. Somehow the lawyers knew the judge or something happened in the back room, without respect to how ever hard the court tried to decide the case. The fundamental measure of good justice is how you feel when you lose, because that's sort of the moment of truth. When everything comes together, you're disappointed, you're disillusioned, all of those things. When you lose a jury trial, and when a client loses a jury trial, they know that they have had that decided by their peers. And I have never heard someone say, well, we didn't get a fair trial. Because fundamentally, and that's what our framers understood, fundamentally the right to a jury trial is the essence of fair justice. And so that's why I'm here. I'll stand for questions if you have any.
Representative Lesh, did you have some words?
Well, I was just going to quote that tweet from Mr. Castor, Madam Chair. The fundamental measure of justice is how you feel when you lose, which I think is prescient for a lot of things around this place. But no other comments from me, Madam Chair. Oh, we do have a fiscal note, and it is zero.
Oh, interesting. Okay, thank you. Are there questions from members? Seeing none, would you like to move the A14 amendment and describe it, please? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Johnson does have a question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, one question. I'm sort of puzzled. I can't think of any other place where the petitioner or the victim in a court proceeding can request a jury trial, only that the defendant or the respondent would be able to request a court trial. The way this amendment is written and a little bit of the bill, it allows the petitioner to request a jury trial.
There is actually, my understanding, and you know, procedurally, all of you are ahead of me. My understanding is the way the bill is presented right now with the amendment, either side can request the right to a jury trial.
Representative Johnson, follow up.
Madam Chair, I'm just puzzled why, if going to a court action, why the petitioner or the victim would be requesting a jury trial. In all my years of law enforcement, the key rule was if you're innocent, request a judge. If you're guilty, go by jury.
Mr. Castor or Representative Lesh? I'm sorry. Were you finished?
So it might, if the petitioner for this is the victim, you'd expect the other one to be guilty. So it doesn't make sense why the petitioner would be able to request a jury.
Well, let me give you this hypothetical in response to your question. First of all, you're speaking in terms of a criminal case, and so the analogy doesn't apply perfectly, but in a criminal context, and these are actual facts from different cases I've been involved in, but where a woman alleges sexual assault in the workplace against the boss has a right to a jury trial. If she brings her claim to civil court now in the state of Minnesota, she does not. That's fundamentally unfair.
Further questions from members? Okay, seeing none, now Representative Lesh, would you like to move the A14?
I do, Madam Chair.
Very good. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those against? Amendment goes on the bill. Let's see. Any further questions from members, or I see Mr. Carlson has come up to the... No comments from Mr. Carlson? Oh, okay. Please identify yourself for the tape and... Oh.
You're done.
Oh, I thought you had comments. My apologies.
I'm uncharacteristically quiet.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Seeing no other questions from... Oh, we do have a testifier coming to the table. Please identify yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce on labor issues. I appear today in opposition to this bill. Our concerns, we have four major concerns with this bill. There hasn't been a right to a jury trial in human rights cases since the enactment of the trial, since the enactment of the Human Rights 363A. This bill would give judges less discretion. Right now, Minnesota judges can already appoint an advisory jury if they think it would be useful in a particular human rights case. This bill would essentially require a jury at the election of the plaintiffs. We believe it's better for judges to have discretion to handle cases as they see fit. This has worked well for almost 4 years. The bill would increase the burden and workload for judges. Jury trials are longer and more difficult. Jury must be selected, more breaks required, a more rigid schedule is necessary, and jurors must be accommodated. By contrast, bench trials are more streamlined, can be scheduled with more flexibility around a judge's other obligations. For example, judges can take a break from a bench trial to handle a motion hearing, which is commonly done. This is less so if the judges have a sitting jury. Requiring jury trials for a substantial block of cases would clog the system, impose greater burdens on judges, and slow the administration of justice in Minnesota human rights cases and others that would be delayed. This bill would increase the burden on court administrators and jurors. If more cases must be tried to a jury, more jurors will be required, and additional time and effort will be required for court administration. This bill would make human rights cases more expensive and slow the administration of justice. The consequence of this change would be that human rights cases would become more expensive to try, the process would be slower and more burdensome, and cases would actually be resolved less quickly. With that, I'd stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gerber. Any questions for the testifier?
One more.
Any comments?
Madam Chair, before the testifier responds, the fiscal note on this bill has stated that this change would amount to one jury trial per year. So that just kind of gives the committee an idea of how much more burdensome we're talking about. With that, I would yield to Mr. Castor, Madam Chair.
I would just like to respond to some of the remarks that were just made. I hear these things quite a bit. This isn't the first time I've heard them. I've never heard a statistical support for this. And in fact, I can tell you from my more than three decades of experience that there is there's probably no difference at the end of the day in terms of the time and effort between a court trial and a jury trial. And in fact, if I were a sitting judge, I would much prefer to have a jury trial, because at the end of the trial, the jury gets a verdict form. They fill out the verdict form, and then the case is done. In a court trial, the court must write findings of fact and conclusions of law. This takes a period of months, and it is a very laborious, detailed process. The jury fills out one form. They answer a couple of questions. They deliberate. They try real hard to decide the questions, and then the case is done and submitted. There is no basis for claiming that jury trials take more time or are less efficient in fact. And for anybody who is in the system and operates in the system on a daily basis, they might make different arguments than I'm making. They're not going to make that argument.
Mr. Castor, just curious, since you've been doing this for so many years, about how many court trials regarding human rights actions do you oversee, or are you a part of every year, would you say?
Well, for the last 15 years, I've taken all of my cases to the federal court, because the jury trial right is intact in federal court, and in state court, I probably had three or four human rights trials before I made that decision that I would go to federal court on these cases. And precisely because in a discrimination context, you know, there, many of the people involved in sitting as judges are like me. They're older white men. And frankly, the perception is from the client that they don't get it, that they don't understand really what a discrimination case is about. Now, whether that's true or not true, that's the perception that they have. And so I find that people are more content with the process if they don't prevail, if they lose, when they've had a jury of their peers decide their case. It's so important to how people feel at the end of the day, which I care about a lot.
Mr. Castor, then how many cases then do you take to the federal court?
I probably have, there's two different questions there. How many cases do I take to the federal court? I probably have about 30 cases at any given time. That's a different question from how many cases are tried. I try one or two cases a year. Very few cases are tried. 97% to 99% of cases resolve. And the question is, when are they going to resolve, and how much before the trial will they resolve? Almost all cases settle. So the talk about how hard it is to try a case, this kind of a case versus a jury case versus a court case, is really a mistaken impression of the impact on the justice system, because almost all cases settle. Now, so how many human rights cases have I tried in federal court? I don't know, maybe somewhere under 10 total.
Okay. Mr. Gerber, you have another question or comment?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Gerber. I mean, I think I'd point out that the comments were just made is that the attorney takes a lot of their cases to the federal court because of the jury trial. Now they're going to take them to state court. So this idea that there aren't going to be more trials, I think it's just been proven wrong. I mean, we're going to have a lot more attorneys that are going to take them back to state court, clog up the systems. I think our other concern is that we want a balanced judicial system. Everybody that goes to law school, I mean, that's one of the things that's pounded into your head. And this really puts the thumb on the scale and says for plaintiff's attorneys to use this as leverage for a settlement. I think one of our concerns is either usually very emotionally charged cases, and that's why they're better for a judge and not a jury. And that's why we think that this is an important right to preserve, this is an important issue to preserve. It's been working well for a long time. I don't understand why it needs to be changed now.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions from members? Representative Yu Russo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me that we can't claim it's been working well for some time if what needs to happen in the cases is that people take it to federal court instead of state court. It seems like we're shunting our responsibility off onto a different system then, and things that ought to stay here can't stay here because we don't have the right system.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, question I have is, since you are taking them into federal court, and comes back to sort of the question I had before, is the respondent capable in federal court to request a jury, or is just the petitioner, or the petitioner, or just the respondent?
No, either side has the right, and this is typically true. Either side has the right to go to request a jury, and then that is binding on the court process. And let me just explain something. In response to the comments that what has happened is cases are flowing over to the federal court, I think I'm the only lawyer that I know who brings my cases to federal court. And the federal court system is a harder system to be in. It's faster. It's more demanding. There's a number of reasons why I prefer it, but one of the reasons is that I don't necessarily want to have the circumstance where I have to go to the district court, lose a case, bring someone's case because the court wouldn't grant a right to a jury trial, and then go up all the way to the state Supreme Court and have that reversed. We're talking about 2 or 3 years of a person's life easily before it's recognized, before the statutory language is recognized as unconstitutional, which it is.
Any further discussion or questions? Seeing none, Representative Lesch renews his motion to re-refer House File 2958 to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Bill passes. Is re-referred.
Representative Hortman. Oh, we do need a motion to approve the March 19th minutes.
So moved.
Representative Scott moves the minutes from March 19th. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Representative Hortman moves that House File 2543 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, we took the harder bill first. Okay. Mr. Chair, members, House File 2543 is an environmental permitting and regulatory streamlining bill brought forward by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I think the reason it's in front of this committee is the data issues. And also, we are changing the way the administrative penalty order and stipulated agreement process will work. If you want to think about state regulatory actions like regular court cases. There's in regular court cases, we have conciliation court and we have district court. Conciliation court is meant to be less complex, faster, for less sophisticated participants, less likely to need a lawyer. And the more complicated cases you want in district court. They take longer. You have to pay a lawyer. In the same thing is true in the regulatory world. There's a thing called an administrative penalty order, and there's a stipulated agreement process that's more complicated. So what we're doing is we're sending more cases to the APO route. When you read the bill, it sounds like we're increasing the size of the fine that the PCA can level against somebody from $10,000 to $20,000. When I read the bill, that's what I thought. But then when you have the bill explained to you and you spend more time with it, you see what we're doing is it's similar to raising the cap on cases that can go to conciliation court. So we're trying to route more conflict through the more streamlined process of the administrative procedure order option. Hopefully that clarifies. So I think we're here because of the data issues and because of that sort of court-like aspect of the bill.
Thank you. So any questions for Representative Hortman? Mr. Kudelka, did you want to, oh, there's an A5 amendment?
Yeah,
did you want to offer that in this committee, Representative Hortman?
I do. It has grown out of a conflict that, this is not what I thought it was. Okay. Because it pertains to the penalty issue. What it does is it impacts the limit by having it adjust with inflation instead of us having to come back every year and say, well, what's the level of cases that should go to the APO route? It would self-adjust through the CPI.
Understood. Any questions from members about the amendment? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hortman, is this a normal custom and around here to have penalties adjusted for inflation?
Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, you know, I don't know when the last time when we increased the conciliation court limit, I don't know if we tied it to CPI. So I think this would be a first step of us doing it this way.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And Representative Hortman, would this also then be adjusted for deflation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I believe so because the CPI can be a negative number.
Representative Scott.
It seems kind of, I just don't think it's probably the best thing to do to be adjusting penalties to inflation. I think it's not commonly done. So I would speak against the amendment.
Any other comments about the amendment? Seeing none, then all in favor of the A5 to get the bill in the shape the author desires, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Representative Hortman, you have testified, Mr. Kudelka, to your bill. Go ahead, introduce yourself for the record, Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Kirk Kudelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I want to thank the author, Representative Portman. I think she did a good job at explaining the administrative penalty order piece. I just wanted to, again, note that the actual penalty amounts is in a different section of statute. So as mentioned, it's more like which tool or what court you go to bring a remedy to that situation. Because our actual civil penalties is in different chapter 115. I just wanted to quick highlight Section 1, the electronic data submission. This is much like TurboTax. Our agency is working on a new database, so reports and different types of permits can be sent to us. People can work on it at home, type in their information, hit save, have the drafts there, still have the private information, just like if they were working on their own software or with pen and paper with hand, and that's private data until they hit the send button, just like they would if they mailed something in the mail to us or sent something to us by email. So it treats it the exact same way.
Any questions for Mr. Kudelka? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just make this comment that the bill author might consider requiring that system have an audit trail and that the people that are submitting it have access to the audit trail. So there's the check and balance of who's looking at their stuff at what time. It would be a security feature. I get a little nervous, just like the campaign finance board hosting the treasurer's reports for the candidates. In this case, there doesn't appear to be any checks or balances on the security or an anonymity factor for the users of the system.
Mr. Portman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, point well taken. We can add language as it goes through the next committee. I think we're going to GovOps. I'm not sure where we go next. Yeah, we're going to GovOps. I've never been to GovOps. That'll be interesting. But I was one of those people who got the letter from the DNR that my record had been looked at. And there should be an audit trail.
Representative Holberg? Okay. Any other questions for Representative Portman or Mr. Kadelka? Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is why 90 days and 150 days? Because coming from the city's perspective, we're held to a 60-day rule to get things done when it comes to any zoning or any of these requests. How come we give a state agency more than double that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, I don't know that the chair wants me to get into that because we had this discussion in environment policy, and that's where those kind of policy issues were addressed. But what I'll tell you is these kind of permits are more complex when you look at the ones that they're dealing with. Some of the air permits are quite complex, and so they're of a different nature. The requests that go to the PCA for environmental review are of a different nature than the ones that go to the local government agencies. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, if that was going too deep into it.
Well, no, I afford a certain measure of latitude, but don't want to delve too deeply into those, especially on a day like this where you have a lot of bills up. Any other questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, then Representative Portman moves that House File 2453 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Portman. Representative Portman, House File 2542. Representative Portman moves that House File 2542 be re-referred to the General Register. There is an A3 amendment. In order to get the bill in the shape the author desires, all in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Representative Portman, go ahead to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2542 is about getting lead and mercury out of the environment. Both of those are neurotoxins, and they're especially harmful for children and developing fetuses carried by pregnant women. So that's why we try to regulate lead and mercury. This particular bill expands the work that's been done in Minnesota to a number of products in commerce where an alternative to the lead or the mercury that's currently used is available. I think this bill is here. Why is this bill here? Oh, because we're giving antitrust exemption for manufacturers to talk to each other. Normally, we don't want players in the market to collude about prices and ingredients and things like that. But when they're talking about product stewardship and management at the end of life, we typically provide an antitrust exemption for manufacturers so they can talk with each other about how they want to coordinate picking up things like used thermostats.
Huh. Well, okay then. Any questions about that? Anyone from the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 2542? Seeing none, then Representative Portman moves that House File 2542 be re-referred to the General Register. House File 2542 as amended. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Portman. That went a lot faster than I thought it was going to. Representative Morgan is here for House File 2918. Can you guys maybe argue a little bit more so we fill some time here?
I'd love to, but it's kind of pointless and stuff.
Well, they know I want to go to the Muppet movie this afternoon.
Waka waka. okay. Representative Morgan, House File 2918, Solar Energy System Residential Use, Restrictions Prohibited. Representative, can I have a motion to move House File 2918 re-referral to the General Register?
I'll move that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Portman moves that House File 2918 be re-referred to the General Register, and there is an A2 author's amendment.
in order to get the bill in the shape the author desires. All in favor of the A2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
Motion passes. Okay, Representative Morgan, two-year bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, members.
Madam.
Representative Scott.
Mr. Chair, excuse me. I'm just wondering if the author could explain this amendment.
Representative Morgan, can you explain the amendment?
I will do that in the context of my introduction here, if that's okay,
right.
Mr. Chair. Representative Scott.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, for entertaining this bill today. House File 2918 is a bill that establishes rights and responsibilities for both the qualified homeowners who live in an association who wish to install rooftop solar systems and for the homeowners associations. This bill is narrow in its scope. It applies only to single-family dwellings where the owner is responsible for the maintenance, repair, replacement, and insurance of the roof. The advocates and I have worked with the representatives of the Community Associations Institute, who represent the Homeowners Association, to improve this bill. The A2 amendment represents some technical changes and some work done on the advice of that organization to help to improve the bill. We have made a commitment to them to continue to work with them as the bill moves along, and they're here today to answer any questions. I don't know if they want to come down, but if folks want to ask them any questions, they are here. Like I said, we're happy to continue to work with them and other stakeholders. I have Ross Abbey here from Fresh Energy, who has helped me on the bill, and he can answer questions as well, and I'm happy to answer any questions that I haven't already.
Questions for members? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Morgan, how has this bill changed since we heard it in our last committee? What do we hear, energy or judiciary? I don't remember which it was. Energy.
Representative Morgan.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, it was in energy. We passed it out of energy, and the only change since then, this is the next place it came, is the amendment we put on today. Basically, we clarified some language about how this affects covenants and so forth of homeowners associations. We changed the unit to dwelling in a couple of places, and we clarified about the roof. There was language about the homeowners association could require that it not be installed above the peak, and we wanted to make sure that we knew that that was of a roof that had a peak, of a pitched roof.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to hear from the homeowners association folks and their level of happiness with this bill.
Homeowners association folks, come on down. Please introduce yourself for the record and address Representative Scott's inquiry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Dorgan. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis, and I'm here on behalf of the Legislative Action Committee of the Community Associations Institute. The Community Associations Institute is the largest, national, and oldest organization in the U.S. representing the interests of co-ops, condominiums, and planned communities. CAI supports environmental and energy efficiency policies that recognize and respect the governance and contractual obligations of community association residents as the best mechanism to enact sustainable environmental policies. We support efforts by state legislatures to empower community associations to build consensus-based solutions regarding environmental initiatives. We oppose government and interest group efforts to override community policy or deed restrictions on single interest issues. And we also oppose attempts to enact laws or regulations that ignore or negate the economic importance of aesthetic controls in common interest communities or other communities or homeowner communities. That's CAI's position, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Dorgan, I was hoping you would specifically address if your last was your last statement meant to be just a blanket opposition to Representative Morgan's bill?
It is a blanket opposition to the bill. We oppose the bill because it ignores the contractual obligations of the members who bought into the communities that might already contain architectural control restrictions. And as I understand it, one of the impetuses for this bill were brought by members of communities that bought into a common interest community where the declaration specifically prohibited items such as solar energy systems. But those declarations prohibit many specific items in many cases. And when you get down to single family dwelling communities versus high-rise condos that have a lot of different units in them, when you're talking about single family dwelling communities, the reason in many cases and the main reason people buy into those communities is because of the architectural controls that are built into the declaration governing those communities. And parts of those controls allow those members to know my neighbor's not going to build perhaps a fence here or a playground in their front yard. Many of the controls already limit specific items like fiberglass door garages or fiberglass doors on the garages or vinyl siding. And are we going to deal with every specific item that might be prohibited in these contracts, which declarations are, and allow homeowners to come in and just avoid them after buying into the communities? We object, CAI objects, to that type of interference in these contracts. We don't see the need for this bill. Associations are well aware of solar energy. I myself have assisted actually a high-rise condominium that I mentioned in putting solar panels on their roof. But that was an association decision, and that's where we believe these types of decisions should be left, not allowing people to buy in and then object to the restrictions that they knew about when they bought.
Okay. Representative Scott.
Mr. Chair, that's my thank you for your testimony. And I guess my next question goes to the bill's author. And so if this amendment is added, then why do lines 2.32 through 3.2 remain in the bill? As I read the amendment, it would do away with the need for an approval process. Am I mistaken?
Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, no. If the covenants have a process for architectural improvements and those kinds of things, just generally, in the Homeowners Association, what we're trying to say here is those approvals have to be dealt with in a timely fashion. So we're trying to set up guidelines. If you go through in Subdivision 4, which the section you're talking about is, the bill is trying to provide some guidelines, like I said, rights and responsibilities for both the homeowners and for the associations to provide a framework in which to work, where folks who own their roof and are responsible for the maintenance of their roof and the insurance and the repairs that they would have to make to their roof have some control, some rights to decide to install rooftop solar. We're not talking about garage doors and fences or anything like that. Who have some rights, personal rights, to install rooftop solar on their roof that they own and maintain and insure. And this provides the responsibilities that homeowners associations can place upon those homeowners. They can require that a licensed contractor install a solar energy system so that it's not some fly-by-night organization. They can require that the owner and each successive owner of the system list the private entity, the homeowners association, as a certificate holder on the homeowners insurance policy. So we're trying to provide these guidelines and a framework in which everyone can operate uniformly for this very narrowly defined group of homeowners who happen to live in these situations where they own the roof, maintain the roof, insure the roof, and are responsible for repairs of their own roof.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. I would like to hear Mr. Dorgan's response to that, please.
Mr. Dorgan, go ahead.
Thank you. You asked earlier if CAI had a blanket opposition to the bill, which we do, but we also have an opposition to several of the provisions in the bill. As I mentioned, most homeowners associations...
Well, Mr. Dorgan, Representative Scott asked if you could specifically address Representative Morgan's statement, if you could do that.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Scott?
Thank you. Representative Morgan covered a lot of things in that response, and so I think what Mr. Dorgan was going to cover was probably going to get to that.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
But he started out speaking about my previous statement. I just wanted to be clear that we were going to address that Representative Morgan's statement. Sure. Go ahead, Mr. Dorgan.
Sure, Mr. Chair. The restrictions that are in the amendment or in the bill prior to the amendment speak to things that most homeowners associations have already included in their governing documents. For instance, the 60-day limitation that has been written into this bill may be different than what the Homeowners Association has already implemented for its architectural control guidelines. So why restrict them to 60 days if their own documents have a different procedure for approving architectural revisions or changes that members may want to make on their property? I mean, why treat them differently? And sometimes in large communities, it may take a 90-day process to get your plan and the plans prepared and then to the Architectural Control Committee. And then if it's approved by the committee, it has to go to the board. Well, these committees and boards meet once a month generally, so the process is already in place to move these things perhaps on a 90-day calendar. So I don't understand, for that one example, why the 60 days is so important. Just leave it to letting a member apply the way the governing documents require members to apply for any other type of modification of their unit or dwelling.
Mr. Chair, if I might. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now I'd like you to go ahead, Mr. Dorgan, with what you previously started to say is specifically what your objections are to the language and the content of the bill.
Mr. Dorgan.
Thank you. I would first like to say for the record, unless I forget, that Representative Morgan and the people from Fresh Energy were maybe perhaps unique in approaching the Legislative Action Committee for CAI and asking for help on this bill. That's unusual, and the committee commends them for doing that. Usually it's just an opposition situation, which hasn't been the case here, and they have cooperated in trying to change the bill to try to make the bill less onerous if it does pass. We have a problem, however, with the numbers that are contained in the bill. The $2,000 cost increase catch-all or 20% production maximum catch-all, we think, are way too low in the event an association has some problems with the way a solar energy system might be designed, even if it meets national standards that are required in the bill that it has to meet. These communities are, when you get to this level, and I'm stressing maybe too much this level, but in most situations where you have high-end single-family homes, the aesthetics are the reason people join that association. And they need to have the guarantee that those aesthetics are going to remain that way. And there are probably many nice solar energy systems that may not match the existing aesthetics, and the association may want to put conditions or suggest changes that would indeed go beyond that $2,000 maximum, which the association couldn't do if this bill passes in its form.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have no further questions.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morgan. This question really has to do with attached homes, not detached. I just got through dealing with an association on my mother-in-law's behalf. And it had to do with the grading issue that spilled water into her unit and other units. And I was just wondering if the installation of solar panels on the roof, if the runoff might go on to an attached unit, is there any remedy for that owner?
Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenthal, thank you for that question. Again, in Subdivision 4 under allowable conditions, the owner or installer, number three, the owner or installer of a solar energy system indemnify or reimburse the private entity or its members for loss or damage caused by the installation, maintenance, use, repair, or removal of a solar energy system. So the bill specifically does provide for that protection of the neighbors of the homeowner.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this not take away some marketing of some associations that want to market to folks that want solar systems on their roof? And does it not interfere with those that specifically don't want that look? So if an association typically wants to market to that, aren't we interfering with the fair market system and the open market that, hey, I want these systems, I want the people that have that on their roofs, and we're going to market specifically to those types of people?
Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, it's a very good question. I have a feeling that bills come before this committee all the time where there's an issue of balancing interests. And I see in this case that we're trying to craft a bill that balances the interests of the homeowner who owns their unit, their roof, and is responsible, economically responsible for the upkeep, repair, maintenance, insurance of their roof, and the homeowners association that they live in. So I think what we're trying to do here is to balance these interests, and I'm guessing that that's something that this committee does on a regular basis.
Representative Hoff. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so instead of those folks that want these systems going through their association and changing their association bylaws and changing those restrictions to allow them to have that, which is, I believe, that's definitely a possibility, that now the minority decides, the minority people interest in the association is going to come to the legislature to intercede to fix their personal problem? Or is this an industry deal that the industry wants to inflict this on an association that doesn't want it, and the industry gets to inflict their will on the rest of the association? Can you explain which one this is?
Representative Morgan.
I'm not sure that it's either one of those, Representative Howe. I think we're looking at a situation where in the state of Minnesota, we're seeing the cost of solar energy, PV installation in particular, drop dramatically. We're seeing an increase in the interest of individual homeowners who want to install this on their roofs. We're seeing that people are going to apply some value to this as far as reducing their electric bills. And in the category of people who own their roof, who are responsible for the maintenance of their roof, how do we balance their individual liberty for that and the collective interest of the homeowners association who put these laws and bylaws into place before this was really an issue for anybody? So I think, again, we're trying to balance these interests.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I still believe that if enough of them in the association believe that this is an issue, that they can change those covenants. There's a process in place to make that happen. But another question I have is, let's say you have an association that requires clay tile on the roof. And from my understanding, putting a solar system such as this on a clay tile roof has some unique challenges. Is this going to allow them to take that tile roof and make it an asphalt roof to put that on so we can bypass another one of the association's restrictions?
Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, I don't believe that this is going to allow people to make those kinds of changes to the aesthetics of the property. We're talking about the solar installation. And I would also suggest to you that we have guidelines here that says that the homeowners association can make some requests for changes in the design and the installation that meet with their aesthetics. We're not breaking new ground here. 20 states have laws like this. This legislature in 2005. Passed a law that said that homeowners associations cannot restrict homeowners from installing a flagpole. We've done that here in Minnesota. The federal government has said that the homeowners associations cannot restrict homeowners associations or homeowners from installing satellite dishes. We're not breaking new ground here. We're trying to find a way to balance the interests of the homeowner who wants to reduce their electric utility costs, wants to have a greener profile, a lower carbon profile, and the homeowners association who have some responsibilities to the entire group, to the entire community.
And Representative Howell, first, Representative Hortman wants to respond to a question beforehand. I do have a brief question for Representative Morgan. Representative Morgan, I live in the city. I don't know a lot about homeowners associations or gated communities. I used to paint houses when I was in college out in suburban St. Louis in gated communities where the women who stayed at home during the day, which was the case in those communities, would get together and decide which color taupe they were going to let me paint their house, which I thought was hilarious because I have a guy with a big Vikings horn on his garage door at a purple house not far from me. Nonetheless, the only thing I'm familiar with is in St. Louis there were
in many of those homes, restrictive running covenants, which the federal government has also determined to be illegal, saying that you wouldn't, if you bought this house, you wouldn't sell your house to a black person. And that was, I think, in the 1950s that those were ruled either unconstitutional or illegal. And all the homeowners agreed on it. This is what we were going to do. And it was their, you know, at the time of their right to do it, the government said it's not in our interest to do that because it's a restrictive racial covenant. Are these laws that you just talked about in keeping with those same changes as against the interests of policy, or is it specific to Minnesota that we've decided this along the lines of flagpoles and the other things you just mentioned?
Mr. Chair, I think I've been distracted by your seeming willingness to compare this to some civil rights victory.
Well, that's because, Representative Morgan, it's my only familiarity that is law school.
Right, and I'm not a lawyer. I'm a mere physics teacher. So I guess I can't answer that question, Mr. Chair. This law absolutely applies to Minnesota. We have borrowed some language from some of the 20 other states that have adopted laws like this. I don't think that this is some major civil rights victory, but I do think, again, it's a way to balance the interests of the homeowners.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. Representative Portman.
Mr. Chair, the district that I represent, the Brooklyn Park side, probably 90% of the people that I door knock live in homeowners associations. I grew up in Representative Scott's district, where I don't think there were any at the time. And Representative Howe, I bet you have just a couple, maybe, homeowners associations. I live in a homeowners association, and we, for 5 years in a row, have not been able to get a quorum at our annual meeting. So we can't change anything. We can't change who the president is. We can't change, you know, what color your roof can be or how thick your shingles have to be or how many trees you have to have in your front yard because we can't get a quorum. So it what happens is you buy a home in a homeowners association and you have these covenants, and the ones that govern my house were written in 1988-89. And so things have changed. And to try to kind of update, I think as a matter of policy, state lawmakers, we shouldn't do this very often. But I think in this case it makes sense because it's an issue that comes up and it causes conflict among members of homeowners associations. And I think it's just better to have a blanket rule across the state that's a little bit more modern, maybe for the benefit of people like me who live in a homeowners association where we can't get a quorum. So, and my Coon Rapids side of the district, I don't think I have any. But on the Brooklyn Park side, it's almost everybody, and they feel a little powerless, to be honest, to change the rules.
Thank you, Representative Horman. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will respond to that. And you know, you choose to live down here in Lesser Minnesota. Those of us in Greater Minnesota enjoy those freedoms.
Fighting words.
So, you know, take your choice of where you what you want to put yourself out to. I enjoy where I live, where I can do what I want, and that's why we live in Greater Minnesota.
Representative Scott,
I am putting in a solar system, by the way.
Did you want to say more to that, Representative Portman? Or
no,
I'm assuming you do.
Mr. Chair, I think that's why people choose to live in the place.
Don't we purchase
Representative Howe, are you just going to sit there and take that? Okay. I'm interested in peace and comity here in committee. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And along those lines, you know, I would never want to live in a covenant community. That's not for me. I want to be able to do what I want. I mean, the city has certain restrictions. And something like this, you'd probably have to get city approval or whatever if you weren't a member of an association. But the fact remains that people that live in associations are bound by a contract. And Representative Portman, you know, if you're having trouble getting a quorum, you got to get your neighborhood organized. You got to go out there with your flyers and say, go to the next meeting. Let's rally. If you're for solar panels, let's go to the next association meeting and let's make our case before the Homeowners Association that this should be allowed. And that's how it's done. We're talking about contract law here. And I just see this as, again, the government telling someone what they can and can't do. Well, they're breaking a contract, allowing someone to break a contract. So that's my opposition to this.
Representative Simon.
it may be moot, Mr. Chair. I was going to say what Representative Morgan did, which was I was on this committee when we did the flagpole bill. So we've done it before for arguably less significant reasons, where the argument then, 2 years ago, was it was about homeowner individual rights to express the patriotism or something else, and we passed that out of this committee. Just a sense of perspective, and it did pass.
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quite a lot of the issues we deal with on this committee have to do with the limitations we put on contracts in some public interest. And this is a situation that involves a public interest because it is the public policy of the state of Minnesota to increase the electrical generation by means of solar energy. And so this advances that public interest. But also there's the question of the townhomes behind me have an even worse situation with their homeowners association than what Representative Hortman describes. The developer, although they wrote covenants into the deeds, failed to set up the homeowners association. And so the homeowners association doesn't even exist to call itself to order. It can't even convene because there's no one on it. And so the people behind me have to go to the city council and try to get variances whenever anything needs to be done back there. And I've also had quite a number of friends who have been in townhomes and they've been on the boards, and there is a great tendency for some of the homeowners associations to become extremely dysfunctional because they are people that don't have experience in governance and they don't have the kinds of checks and balances built into their associations that we have in other systems of governance to get themselves out of those pickles. So I, as Representative Hortman says, we shouldn't be doing this very often, but we do have a situation here where there is a public policy behind it. And there is a reality behind it for many people, and it is not the case that we absolutely honor contracts regardless of their provisions. So I'm in favor of this.
Mr. Johnson, Mr. Chair, as has been stated, these covenants are basically contracts. I actually have one in my community, in the neighborhood I live in. But before we signed it and built our house, we also read the covenant and saw, and before we did it, we made sure there was a sunset date in it, which is, if I remember correctly, this year. With these covenants and what this committee is talking about, the importance of reading the covenants and reading those things to make sure what's in them beforehand before you sign the dotted line. So it's, and I have a big problem with these little carve-outs, because we have some covenants that you have to get permission from the association as to even what color to paint your house, what color the shingles have to be on your house, what type of trees you can put in your front yard, and what trees you can have, which is a lot more than whether or not you can put a solar panel on. It's the people who moved into these knew what the covenants were ahead of time, and now they should change them in their own covenants in their own communities and not have this legislature change it because maybe one person out of 10 feels they're glided because they didn't get what they want.
Any other questions for the testifiers? Anyone else from the public who wishes to be heard on this bill, House File 2918 as amended? Seeing none, then Representative Hortman renews her motion that House File 2918 be re-referred, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Alverson.
Representative Halverson, can I have a motion that Representative Halverson's bill, House File 1961, be re-referred to the General Register? Representative Rosenthal moves it, and there is also an author's A1 amendment. Representative Halverson, in order to get the bill in the shape the author so desires, all in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. To your bill as amended, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This bill is related to public disclosure for public officials, including those of us who are on the table. And I want to start by just letting members know that I bring this bill forward not because I have great concerns about the public integrity of the elected officials in this state or at the local level. In fact, I think Minnesota enjoys a reputation of having, in general, a high level of integrity among its public officials. However, what we've discovered as laws have modernized over the years and problems have cropped up, more so in other states, but some concerns in this state about what the public is able to know about conflicts of interest that might exist with public officials. This is an attempt to strike a balance between what the public expects to know and understand and the way that we do business here at the Capitol. So it makes a few changes to current law. First of all, it requires the Campaign Finance and Disclosure Board to make audits and investigations on compliance with our campaign finance laws and disclosure laws within the limits of the resources of the Campaign Finance Board. So there is no fiscal note that comes along with this bill. It requires the disclosure of possible conflicts of interest, which we already do as officials. We add spouses to that. And what I'm finding in talking to people is the addition of spouses really meets the public standard. It's the way a lot of people are already operating. So an example would be we already know that if we as individuals would be uniquely and significantly impacted financially by a piece of legislation that we should be voting on, that we would go through the steps to recuse ourselves and be public about that. This would add the spousal expectation. So if my spouse was going to be uniquely and significantly financially impacted by a piece of legislation that we would be voting on, I would set myself to the same recusal standards as I would for myself, knowing how closely our finances tend to be tied among spouses. The economic interest form is expanded for public officials. Originally, the bill had spouses. We just took that out in our amendment. It has a list, as you can see, for folks who are private contractors. There's been a lot of discussion and a lot of call from the public for information about people who might just be writing consultant on their form if they're an independent consultant, if they hang out their own shingle, or if they own up to 25% or more of a business, that we provide more information about what type of work gets done. These codes that are listed in your bill are codes that are taken from the list, a much larger and more extensive list that the IRS provides. For the purposes of this legislation, we've pared those down. So we increase essentially what the public knows about what our business interests are and provide some more specificity. We do not go so far as to ask private contractors to list their clients' names. And I've taken the personal stand that I think that the client is due that type of privacy. And so we don't ask for client names, although there has been discussion and requests to have that be part of the legislation. Finally, we make it very clear that as audits are performed, that information that is gathered by an auditor that is considered private data continues to be private data. And the only disclosures are after an audit if it's needed to be disclosed for the purpose of the findings. I had a brief conversation with Representative Holberg, who I know had to leave, and she recommends adding
some language to be able to identify an auditor so that there's a little bit more of a trail. I think you had a conversation similar to that about an earlier bill. And certainly I'm open to continuing to work on that. That's the bill.
Thank you, Representative Howson. Questions for members? Representative Simon.
Well, I just want to say thank you, Representative Halverson, for doing this. I know you've worked on this for about a year, or close to a year, and this is tough. I know many people have tried to do this before. I think you've mostly struck the right balance here, especially when it comes to disclosing kind of the nature of the work done for someone who lists themselves as a contractor or a consultant. I think you've come up with a fair balance. I remember when you first started talking about this, there was pressure on you and on us as legislators to have people, as I think California does, list clients. And I think, I know that you ran into some real pushback there, and so I think this is a common sense kind of balance. But I'm interested, you appear to have backed away here from the spousal reporting, presumably because you got some pushback from other folks. I just want to say, and I know you're doing that in the interest of getting the votes and getting some harmony here and on the floor and perhaps in the Senate too, you know, my personal opinion is I think the public has a right to know what our spouses do for a living. It's not an onerous thing to list the name of your employer and the name of your spouse's employer on there. People, I think, have a right to do that and connect dots and keep us on our toes. I don't think it's intrusive. I don't think it's an invasion of privacy. They have every right to know what my wife does for a living or your husband and have that in a public document. I don't think we should hide that. And while I think I understand that that opens up a certain new front, perhaps in the political wars, I say so be it. You know, that information, and this maybe cuts both ways, is so readily available anyway. Someone could probably Google you or Google me and kind of figure out on their own what our spouses do, probably, but not always. Or they could troll around Facebook and figure it out. So maybe that cuts both ways. It could cut against putting into the bill because, hey, someone who's determined to figure out what my wife does for a living could figure that out anyway. Or it could cut in favor of it. So in a more perfect world, I would favor keeping that in there. I just think the public has the right to know. If my wife owned 50% of an ethanol plant and we voted on a bill here that would in particular benefit that ethanol plant as opposed to all ethanol plants, she doesn't, by the way, it's just a hypothetical. If that were to happen, absolutely the public has the right to know that, and I should have to put that on paper. Now, one would think that without having to do that, I would do the right thing anyway and recuse myself from a vote, but what if I didn't? Or what if I was too busy? Or what if, in a wink or a nod, I was just tempted to do the wrong thing? You know, I think the people who serve here are very ethical, without regard to party or ideology. But sometimes people lapse, and I think having to disclose this would be a reminder. So I'm sorry that we're taking the spousal information out, but I understand you've got to get the votes. But I think otherwise you have a really balanced approach here in moving Minnesota in the right direction, which other states have done, and we really have lagged far behind in this stuff. So thanks.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Simon, for that. I tend to agree with Representative Simon on that. That was what my comments were going to center around. You know, it's really important to know what these spouses do. Maybe you have a spouse that's a lobbyist for something that you're actually going to be taking a vote on. And even if you're not swayed by that, the perception is everything. And so I'm sorry to see it be removed as well. So that's just my comment. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments for the bill's author? Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where's the National Guard guy or the reservist? What do they put down for this? Because I'm looking at my own interest going, I don't know where I fit.
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Howe, if you are an employee and not an independent contractor, you would list the name of your employer like we already do. So this would be in situations where you hang out your own shingle as an independent contractor. And so I haven't been a member of the National Guard, but I assume that if you're getting, you're an employee of the state, the government.
Any other questions for the bill's author? Seeing none, then Representative Rosenthal moves House File 1961 as amended. be referred to the general register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Members, we have no other bills on the calendar for deadlines. I want to thank everyone for working very hard all throughout this busy time. It was a short session. We packed a lot in. The staff, Emily Leffholz and Jay Zhang, did a great job pulling us together, and I want to thank our research staff as well, who did outstanding in helping out, and members of the minority. So with no other Rips and Scott?
Yeah, I just would chime in and say ditto to that, and just an outstanding staff. And just one other question, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if in the coming days, if we're going to take up House File 2281, it's a Winkler bill regarding our little get-out-of-jail-free cards. Just wondering if I know that you asked for that to be sent to this committee, or are we going to be hearing that bill?
Rips and Scott, I doubt it. But we'll see. I haven't heard anything, any new information since the hearing last night. If I do, I'm open to reconsidering that position. But right now, the bill is not ready for prime time.
All right, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're truly a sick
person. Committee's adjourned.